I would like to welcome Heather Shoemaker to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you, Aaron. Good to be here.
Last time you were here, we were talking about your book, It's Okay Not to Share, and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. That book focused on kids of what age?
It was intended for kids of the preschool age mostly, you know, kindergarten, preschool, although I've heard people tell me that it's ageless and they use it on their spouses and their college kids.
Your children were about that age when you wrote the book. Is that true?
When I wrote the first book, actually my oldest child was about 2 months old when I started the ideas for it. So it wasn't really centered around my own children's experiences. It was centered on around the ideas. But yeah, they sort of, it took a little while to get the book published, so they did enter the ages I was writing about.
And this new book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids, you're focusing on...
Well, this age group is preschool, kindergarten, and into elementary school, so it's a bit of a broader range.
And your rules, your renegade rules, are rules that are research-based. You cite the work of child development specialists, cognitive psychologists, and a whole array of other specialists. Would you talk about the research that went into the book?
Sure. Some of the research, was looking at the scientific basis for some of these ideas, and some of it was interviewing families and teachers and doing classroom observations. So it was a mix of types of research.
And based on the first book, you had a lot of feedback from parents and teachers. How did that work into the text?
How did that inform the new book?
Yes.
Well, they were flinging ideas at me, and they were saying, well, you didn't write about princesses, or you didn't write about teasing, or what about this and what about that? And so I was gathering all their input. In fact, one person said, why isn't there an index in the first book? So this book has an index. But, you know, I was gathering lots of ideas. But really, the first book, I was trying to say everything. And at a certain point, the book got so big that my editor called me and said, Heather, this book is so massive and so it's going to be so fat, no one will buy it. They're going to be intimidated by its size. And so we mutually agreed to slice out several chapters to make it a more manageable size for people. But these chapters then really wanted to have a home in a new book, and I started gathering up new ideas and collected them around a whole potpourri of new ideas, from technology to recess to homework to risk and safety second, just a whole mix of topics and the princesses.
And the book starts with healthy risk, safety.
Yes. Well, the first chapter, in fact, is called Safety Second, which usually startles people a bit because all our lives we hear this mantra, safety first, safety first. And I think we're also sort of living in a culture, especially the parents, a culture of fear, where everything is fear-driven. Oh, you can't let kids walk down the street by themselves. You can't do this. You can't do that anymore. There's a perception of fear. And yet kids desperately need independence and healthy risk. And so, you know, safety second is really to a mindset to think about what are the risks that we're preventing our kids from taking. And I'm not just talking about physical risks, though some basic ones might be running too fast. Okay, what's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to fall down and skin their knee. But then they learn that running on concrete too fast might cause that to happen. So there's physical risks, but there's also risks that we don't even think about as risks sometimes, which are social risks, asking a friend to play or asking a new person to play and maybe being rejected. Emotional risks like feeling bad, getting angry, being sad. We try to protect kids a lot from those sorts of feelings. And creative risks, which to me is giving kids enough downtime to pursue their own ideas and take those creative risks. We need to unschedule them enough that they can take those creative risks.
Another risk you mentioned is talking to strangers.
Yes.
And you say it's okay to talk to strangers.
Yeah, well, we have in our minds, besides safety first, a whole litany of parenting, truths that we think are the truths, and they've been handed down. And one of them is don't talk to strangers, right? It's all been hammered into our heads. But if you look at the research on that, actually talking to strangers is safer than it is to have a message, don't talk to strangers. So for one reason, it doesn't work. It doesn't help keep kids safe by not talking to strangers. Young children are confused about what a stranger is. They think it's someone that they don't know their name. So once a stranger tells them their name, well, they're not a stranger anymore. Or maybe a stranger is somebody who has a beard or somebody who looks different than their family. So they get confused about what a stranger is. But also, it's well proven that the greatest harms that kids face really is, whether it's sexual abuse or other kinds of harm like that, is from people kids know. Mm-hmm. So friends, family, neighbors, those are the people that aren't in the stranger category, but those are the ones that statistically hurt kids the most. So it can backfire to say, oh, well, Uncle so-and-so or Mom or so-and-so is fine just because they're family or they're someone you know.
And part of the safety thing has helped develop this whole concept of helicopter parents and tethered children. And I see young kids all the time carrying phones. Their parents always know where they are.
Right. Yeah, I have quite a bit in this section about how to untether your kids. And a lot of it, of course, starts with us as the adults, because we need to take small steps to untether them and work through our own prejudices about what's safe and what's not. And I think once people dig into the child development and dig into the research, which I show in some of these chapters, they can see that it is healthier for kids to take healthy risks, not crazy dangerous risks, but healthy risks, and gain some of that independence. They need to gain some street smarts. And some of that can mean simply asking someone a question, being able to approach somebody and start gauging reactions with strangers and have practice with it. Because one thing that people say is it's strangeness we need to have kids be wary of, not strangers. And face it, a lot of strangers are the ones that help children. So if somebody's lost or somebody's scared, it's going to be a parent passing by who's going to help, or it's going to be the policeman, or it's going to be the firefighter, or it's going to be somebody who's a stranger who ends up being the helper.
And the child needs to have the social skills to ask for help and identify who can help them. You have a number of hot-button issues. Why recess is an issue?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm talking about, you know, recess in elementary schools.
Yes.
Some people just assume the kids are getting enough recess and that there's, you know, we think about our own school days. In my elementary school, we had 3 recesses a day. That was normal: morning recess, lunch recess, and afternoon recess. Recess is getting shorter, they're getting fewer, and they're getting more organized. So what I mean by more organized, sometimes gym class is being substituted for recess. Now, any kid can tell you that gym class is not the same thing. They'll say, well, in gym class, the teacher tells you what to do and you can't choose your friends on your team.
It's an organized...
It's organized, teacher-led, structured activity.
Yep.
But there's certainly a strong emphasis on physical movement and obesity epidemic concerns in this country, and that's legitimate. But we can't sacrifice recess thinking that, oh, gym class is a good substitution. Kids need a break. They need a break, not just physically, they need it emotionally and socially, because they're being asked to pay attention and do what they're told all day long, which is very hard, and they need those breaks in between. And the research shows that kids who have recess regularly and enough of it, they are able to focus their attention, their memory improves, their ability to learn and problem solve during the academics when they're back in class is much better, and so is their behavior. And if anyone's worked around young kids, we sort of know this as a fundamental truth, but sometimes the schedules, the push for more curriculum, edges out recess, and kids are often getting only 1 recess a day, or a good percentage of kids in our country are getting 0 recess, starting even in kindergarten and first grade, no recess at all.
You also talk about homework in elementary school and banning homework.
Yes.
And I'm sure you've gotten a lot of emails on this.
Yes. Well, I posted a blog post that got me about 140,000 people reading it. And it is a hot-button topic. There is And I'm glad you mentioned elementary school homework. The chapter title is Ban Elementary Homework. And I think it's really key to focus on the different ages, because what the research shows is that homework's academic benefits, which is, of course, the reason we ask kids to do this kind of work anyway, is to help them in school. Homework's academic benefits are highly age-dependent. So in high school, there's benefit if it's not too much, if it's in moderation, say no more than 2 hours a night. It can really help high schoolers with their academics. Middle schoolers, very slightly, but elementary, none at all. And this is not just one study. This is a meta-analysis of 180 different research studies that have all been peer-reviewed. So it's an analysis of the research. It's research of the research that shows that it's all age dependent and that there is no evidence of academic benefit for homework for elementary school students. However, the same analysis shows that there is an impact, and the impact is having young kids develop negative attitudes towards school and learning. So we're getting exactly what we don't want. We're not getting the academic benefit, yet we're getting negative attitudes towards school. And when homework starts early, the way it is these days, starting in kindergarten and in some places in preschool, it's setting kids up for more than a decade, 12, 13 years of schooling and having these attitudes, these bad attitudes towards school and homework. And that's not helpful for kids.
Another hot topic has to do with the prevalence of technology and screens in children's lives. And there seem to be two parts of that, the parents and the children. Could you sort of talk about that?
Yes. I think we often, when we're worried about the balance of technology and screens in kids' lives, we focus on what's wrong with the kids. But we do need to look at ourselves. And I have a whole chapter focusing on the adults. It's called Discipline Your Phone. We need to start thinking, it's a new aspect of parenting, and adults are not that used to how to deal with technology themselves yet. They're figuring it out. But we have to be aware that we're models, just the way we model nutrition. So, for example, if you're raising kids, it's a good idea not to sit down and eat fudge and potato chips every night for dinner in front of your kids. You need to model eating the balanced meals. And we recognize that. There's junk food out there. We can model how to deal with that. But we also need to do the same thing with technology. So we need to model how we deal with people when they're right in front of us. What's the etiquette of different things? Parents often will pick up their kids from school and still be on the phone. These are things that parents need to think about. One of these sacred times, how can we be modeling proper social and emotional connection with other human beings? Technology has wonderful aspects, but we need to put it in its place, and we need to model it for our kids. The other aspect of technology, of course, is what good it can do at different ages. And as kids grow, their relationship with technology will change and grow. But when they're quite young, and let's say early elementary and preschool ages, they really have very little use for technology as far as the things that they need to concentrate on for learning and growing. And I'm talking about learning basic emotional coping skills, learning how to deal with conflict and conflict mediation, learning all kinds of physical and social skills. They need to be able to be in the real world the majority of their time, and we need to preserve that so that they have time to gain those skills.
At one point in the book, you talk about the Amish iPad. It's a metaphor at that point, but could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Well, the idea is that the Amish, we often think, oh, they just reject all technology. But it's not true. In many Amish communities, Amish teenagers will text, for example. So what the Amish are, they're not against all technology. They are technology selective, and they evaluate each new thing that's invented, and they look at their communities and their family values, and they decide, the elders actually decide for them, but they decide how this technology could help or hurt. How could it bring the family more together and the community more together? And then they adapt the technology or modify it and put it in its place. So not that we need to take all the values of an Amish community, but to be technology selective and to examine how it behaves in our families and how we can set guidelines so that we preserve what's most important to us.
One thing you seem to be concerned about is the use of video games.
Well, the video games, there's all sorts of video games. You know, there's ones that are more creative. There's ones that have very little creativity to them. I think that video games tend to be prepackaged fun. They tend to be entertainment, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, a good movie, entertainment, a good video game. But it doesn't, when you're doing that sort of play, you're not doing other sorts of play that can be more valuable. So it's more about a balance of time. There's nothing wrong with having fun, and kids today love to have fun with video games. But it's a manner of, especially the younger they are, the less they need that kind of time taker upper, is what it is. It's all about opportunity cost. And as a child gets older, they have different needs, and their relationship to that can change.
Now, we're surrounded by video all the time, television and the various electronic devices. How do you help children cope with the current events, the school shootings, the terrorism? How do they integrate that into their world without becoming too fearful?
Yes. Well, this is an important part of the book also, is dealing with children's empathy and emotions and how they cope with disasters in the news and how they even cope with disasters in storybooks, you know, if the main character dies in the end. So one thing that we have done as a culture is try to sanitize everything for kids. This is another part of our overprotection. So we'll, in the little red hen, instead of little red hen eating the bread by herself, suddenly they all sit down and they're friends and they share everything, or the fox doesn't eat the gingerbread boy. It's sort of a sanitization of children's stories. And that's an aspect we're trying to protect kids, overprotect kids from difficult emotions, including sorrow. So it's important for kids to be able to experience the full range of human emotions. And one safe way to explore some of the difficult ones is in storybooks. So we need those sad endings. As far as news and disasters, and you mentioned shootings and so on, you know, kids often they hear more than we think. They have their radar out, and they can develop fears and even feel guilty for things that may happen in the news. So sometimes we just need to check in with them and saying, you know, have you heard anything that, especially if something's been in the news all day and it's just happened, you know, is there anything you're worried about? Kids often have questions and misconceptions of how things happened. And if a child asks you directly, it's important to answer honestly, because if a child is old enough to ask, she's old enough to get an honest answer.
You have experience from your first book and now the second book. How do parents, grandparents, teachers use this book, or how would you want them to use the book, the books?
Yes, well, these books are designed for busy people. So you're able to jump into any chapter and read what's relevant. You don't have to start at the beginning and go forward. And that's what I find people do, is that they read, if they have a child who's having trouble with, say, finding appropriate risk-taking, read the section on risk. Or if there's a lot of teasing going in the household, jump to the section on mean words. You don't have to read it in order. There's also a lot of helpful words to say at the end. So if you can't remember everything, there's actual phrases that you can pull out. And there's sample scripts and things. So if your child is overburdened with homework and they're crying every night at the kitchen table and you're having these parent-child conflicts, you're turning into the homework cop, and the child is turning into the chief grumbler who won't do anything unless you really badger them. And this is unhealthy family relationships. And if that's going on, there's sample scripts that you can use to approach your child's teacher and say, this is what's happening in our house, and this is what we want to see. There's words for the teachers too. Teachers and parents are partners on this, and partners need to tell each other when something's wrong.
Yeah, it's one of the things I really admire about the book, where you talk about the negotiation that can take place between parents and teachers to best further the interests of the kid.
Well, I think there's a lot of fear there, too. I hear so many teachers tell me, well, if I don't assign homework, the parents will get mad at me, even preschool-age teachers.
And that's true.
And the parents saying, well, I've got to have the kid do the homework. I know they need to go to bed. I know this is not what they need. I know they need to go out and play, but they've got to do their homework because the teacher said. And I think the adults really have to stop being afraid of each other. You know, go if there's something concerning you, go talk to the other side, because the kids are caught in the middle of it. And the children's needs are for play and other types of learning that's non-academic and good sleep. I mean, if you want to know how to get better behavior and higher test scores and better learning in the classroom, put the kids to bed earlier. That's proven to be more effective.
Up through the SATs.
Yes, it's not glamorous. But it's much more effective, and homework, as we talked about, has no evidence that helps the elementary ages.
What were the most challenging topics to write about based on feedback from teachers and parents? And there must have been some things that were very difficult.
Well, I think the most challenging section in the book was actually about technology, because books take a while to write, and by the time you've written a sentence, the technology has changed underneath your feet. So I tried very hard to make it focus on the bigger ideas rather than a specific game or a specific technology.
Well, both books have been interesting to read. The first book was helpful to us as grandparents. I'm sure it was very helpful to parents. So what's next? Are we going to move up to high school age?
Yeah, I've gotten lots of suggestions. Someone said, how about a book focused on teenagers saying it's okay to crash the car, which will not be written. No, my next book, would be my third book, is going to be a departure from Renegade Parenting. So I have the two Renegade Parenting books. But the third book is going to go back to my roots, which is environmental stories. It's going to focus on land conservation in the Great Lakes.
Oh, that's terrific. And when do you expect that to be out?
It will be out in 2017 in the spring.
Great. So, Heather Shoemaker, great to see you. Glad you're here. Looking forward to the next book. Where can readers find more information about you? Your website is?
My website is heathershoemaker.com, and there's books and book club and all kinds of information there.
Heather Shoemaker, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio.